Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this special Council on Foreign Relations conference call. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you for joining us. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We are delighted to have Edward Djerejian with us today to discuss the status of the ongoing international peace negotiations on Syria. Ambassador Djerejian has served, in addition to many other posts, as U.S. Ambassador to Syria, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and Special Assistant President Ronald Reagan. Over the course of his career, played lead roles in the Arab-Israeli peace process, the U.S.-led coalition against Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, the successful efforts to end the civil war in Lebanon, the release of the U.S. hostages in Lebanon, and the establishment of collective and bilateral security arrangements in the Persian Gulf. And he is currently the founding director of the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. Welcome, Ambassador Djerejian. Thank you for joining us today from Houston, where I understand you are having a bit of a snowstorm there. It would be great if you could begin by giving us an overview of what is happening at the peace conference, what's being negotiated, and what progress you think is being made.
Well, thank you very much, Irina, for inviting me. I'm delighted to enter this conversation with our colleagues and members of the CFR. I'll just give you a basic substantive summary of what my thinking is. Some of you may have read some of the stuff I've done recently on this, and then I'd like to really engage with our interlocutors. In terms of the Geneva II conference, the good news is that it hasn't collapsed yet. The good news is that the Syrian government, represented at a very high level by Walid Mualim, the foreign minister, Hutena Shaban, Bashar al-Assad's presidential advisor and spokesperson, and other high-level officials, is meeting with elements of the Syrian opposition who, as you all know, refused to come to Geneva unless the government agreed up front that any political transition in Syria meant that at the very beginning Bashar al-Assad had to step down. They simply did not want to deal with the brutal leader of Syria. But we must give credit, I think, to Lakhdar Brahimi and his predecessor, Kofi Annan, who really worked very quietly in a very frustrating environment, both within Syria and internationally, to get to this point where the opposing sides are sitting in the same room. So, in diplomatic parlance, that's a minor breakthrough, and neither side has yet bolted. Now, having said that, the discussions are very fragile. They can break down at any point, but so far they have been addressing one another through Lakhdar Brahimi. It's sort of an interesting format. They don't speak to each other directly, but at this U-shaped table, they address their remarks to Lakhdar Brahimi, who's at the end of the U-shaped table, and avoid as much as possible direct conversations with one another. But God knows what's happening in the corridors, if there are some side talks or some private talks. As a former diplomat, I hope that's happening. It's usually the way things do get accomplished is that off the public conference table, if the sides are actually contacting one another and some substantive discussions are taking place there. There's no way we would know that at this point, but I hope that is also happening. Now, the major purpose of the Geneva II conference, which is based on the Geneva I communique, is to obtain a ceasefire, stop the killing, establish humanitarian assistance, and begin discussions between the regime and the opposition for a political transition in Syria, which ultimately everyone anticipates would lead to a post-Assad era. The key question there is, when will the post-Assad era kick in? But that is the major substantive goal. And another very important goal, I think, that we should keep in mind, especially in the United States and Washington, is that I think every effort should be made to preserve the territorial integrity and the independence and the sovereignty of the Syrian state, because Syria is in the heart of the Arab world. Whatever happens in Syria is having already a very detrimental impact on its neighbors. But if Syria truly implodes into a free fall of sectarian violence and civil war, one can say we're there already. The impact on Iraq, on Jordan, on Israel, on Lebanon, on Turkey will be massive, and it will be highly detrimental. And it is my view that the international community, albeit being relatively reluctant to get more directly involved, will be forced to get involved, because the stakes are simply too high in the Middle East for the region to start dismantling itself at that point. So the stakes are high in all of this. I think the Lakhdar Brahimi has been smart to focus the discussions on relatively modest agenda, namely that the parties focus on limited ceasefires in specific localities within Syria, with an initial focal point being on Homs, which has been devastated, and trying to establish a aid corridor into Homs. They have not succeeded in doing that yet, but that's obviously on the agenda. If that succeeds, or they would probably go to other aid corridors, to other besieged parts of Syria. The other limited goal is ceasefire, local ceasefires in various entities in Syria, not a national overall ceasefire throughout the whole country. That's mission impossible at this stage. But if they could achieve limited ceasefires in specific localities within Syria, that could have another confidence-building impact, and then reach out further throughout the country. The other thing is politically symbolic, but it's a humanitarian gesture also, is prisoner releases and exchanges that would also, I think, give the opposing parties a stake in talking to one another. So that's what's on the agenda now. It's going to take time. Again, let me repeat, these discussions can collapse at any moment, and we'd be back to ground zero, if you will. Some of the fault lines, of course, is that the opposition is very, it's not a unified opposition. The Syrian National Council represents part of it. There aren't that many representatives in Geneva who are the fighters on the ground, the rebel forces on the ground, if you will, the Syrians who are fighting in various localities, and of course the Islamic radical groups, except there's one group there, but it's a more moderate one, but the Islamic radical groups, if you will, the truly bad guys, the Al-Qaeda affiliates and ISIS and these other groups, are not represented in Geneva, and they are a real problem. This is one of the potential minefields in Syria, is that the sectarian violence and the civil war has drawn in foreign fighters, especially from Iraq, and Al-Qaeda affiliates from all over the Arab world. And they are taking advantage of the chaos to try to establish their agenda, which is to establish a Islamic state in Syria. They do not represent in any way a majority of the opposition. They represent the minority of the groups fighting in Syria, but they are very well organized and have proven to be quite effective militarily, like the Jabhat al-Nusra group. So that's one of the terrible consequences of what we're seeing. I think one point we have to keep in mind, it's important for both sides, ultimately. We've seen this in other conflicts, and I've noticed on a list of participants in this call, there are people who have been there in negotiating the various conflicts that are on the line today. But it's important for both sides to conclude that neither one can prevail militarily for real compromise solutions to be explored. There's still a feeling, I believe, on the part of the regime and a part of the opposition that if they just hang in there, they can defeat the other side militarily. As long as that perception prevails, especially on both sides, it's going to be difficult to get them to tackle real compromise solutions. But if there is some limited progress along the lines I indicated on these smaller objectives, I'm not diminishing them, they're important. I think the very process of negotiations under the Geneva formula can allow the parties to begin to discuss trade-offs and approaches for a framework of political transition that will involve these hard compromises I'm talking about. Let me put another factor on the table here. Bashar al-Assad has, from the very beginning of the Arab Spring coming to Syria in 2011, has consistently indicated that presidential elections that are scheduled for June of this year should be respected and adhered to. Of course, he will do everything to rig those elections, and he has the capability of doing that, but the situation in Syria is quite different now with all the turmoil. But again, if these Geneva talks move forward, there are local ceasefires that grow into larger ceasefires, and there's that the parties come to the point where they can start discussing a process of constitutional electoral reforms under strict international monitoring. Jimmy Carter has advocated this recently in December. That could provide the political space for the opposition and the regime to contest the power structure at the ballot box. Now, I'll be the first to say this is a very optimistic scenario, but it is a substantial option that should be kept in mind. And I find it very interesting that Rouhani, the president of Iran and the Iranians, have said that the solution in Syria is through elections. Now, the Iranians are key players in Syria for their support of the Assad regime. They are key players in their support of Hezbollah, that is actually fielding troops in Syria in support of Bashar al-Assad's regime. I think it's a mistake not to have Iran at the table in Geneva because they're such a massive player that I think that without illusions as to what their position would be, they would obviously be defending the regime to a certain extent. But let's face it, I believe that none of the external parties, outside countries and powers, has a national security interest in the implosion of Syria and massive instability in Syria that could spread throughout the region. They have other tactical objectives, but I think that's a common thread that can bring together an international force to institute this this political transition. I remember when Kofi Annan was the mediator, he called a number of us so-called Syria experts to Geneva, and Lakhdar Brahimi was there also, and Prince Turki bin Faisal and other people. And I remember he put on the table at that time that he wanted Iran to be represented. And he asked me, I was the only American there, he asked me if what Washington's reaction to that would be. I said it would be very problematic because of the other heavy agenda we have with Iran, be it the nuclear issue, be it terrorism, be it a whole history of animosity. And I said Washington most likely would not go along with it, and that happened to be true. And, of course, the Saudis found that to be very problematic to have Iran at the table. So some of that still lingers on, but there's no question in my mind that, you know, that Iran's shadow looms large on the Geneva conference. I'll end with one comment also, if, God willing, these talks in Geneva continue, and they do make progress on some of these limited objectives, that could open up the field to other participants joining the negotiations and the discussions, maybe even Iran, but also different opponents, maybe from within Syria, that would join into the talks. And I would even venture, and I must admit up front that I have no way of proving this, that there must be elements within the Assad regime that are very troubled by the prospects of where this is all going. So let's hope that these talks do succeed in obtaining some limited common ground and then could move to the ultimate objective. Irina, I think I'll end on that and open it up.
Thank you so much. Let's open up, Lindsay, to everybody on the call.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press the star 1 now. Our first question comes from Matthew Welch with the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Thank you. And I'm here with Ambassador Johnny Young as well, who sends his greetings to everyone.
Particularly
to the ambassador for his fine presentation. Our question would be, what would be the optimum role that the U.S. could play to address the severe refugee and humanitarian concerns, especially in Syria itself and also in the neighboring countries? And how can we best encourage the U.S. to play that role?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think the U.S. has been the major donor for humanitarian assistance in Syria. It's a pretty large figure. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue here, but the United States is allocating a lot of money for humanitarian assistance. I think the we're all aware of the tragic circumstances of, 4 million people dislocated, half of them within Syria, the other half outside of Syria. We know the plight of the Syrian refugees in Lebanon and Turkey and Jordan. And they've gone elsewhere, too, especially Syrian Christians have tried to seek a refuge outside of the Middle East itself. But I think the United States should continue to take the lead, but take a strong lead on, for example, if they do make progress on establishing these aid corridors to Homs and other localities in Syria, the United States should really step up to the plate and play a lead role in the international community to assure that the humanitarian assistance goes to the people who need it. And that's a tricky scenario. And that the aid doesn't fall into the hands of the regime for their own political ends.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Charles Cohen with the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs.
Thank you for a fine presentation. I'd like to get your opinion as to whether you think Bashar al-Assad, with the thousands of deaths that he's ultimately responsible for, can he remain a credible president of a reconstituted Syria? Thank you.
Well, I personally believe that he cannot. To say the least, he's discredited himself. If you look at the origins of the so-called Arab Spring in Syria, in the town of Daraa in southern Syria, we must not forget that this started out as very peaceful protests largely led by young people, and in the case of Daraa, by high school students. And and what they did is, I think it's very symbolic what they did. The first protest, they demonstrated in front of the local Ministry of Interior building, which represents the political regime and the oppression, the political oppression, and sprayed graffiti on the building. And remarkably, the second building they went to was the Syrian telecom company, which is part of the monopoly of the Assad, the in-laws. And what's interesting on that is that these kids were striking symbolically at the political regime and the kleptocracy, not oligarchy, but the kleptocracy of this regime, where economic favoritism was dispensed at the very top. And they realized that their prospects as young kids were stifled not only by lack of political participation, by lack of economic participation. So this all started rather peacefully, like it did in other parts of the Arab world, in Tunisia and Egypt, but then quickly turned violent. And the violence was really, as best as I can determine, was perpetrated by the regime firing on protests as they got larger and larger. Having served in Syria under the father, Hafez al-Assad, when I was ambassador there between 1988 and 1991, I have no illusions about the security apparatus in Syria. It is one of the most brutal, one of the most efficient. As you can see, that Bashar al-Assad and this regime have hung on so long after this devastating turmoil in the country, where they've lost control over sovereignty over large swaths of Syria. But the Syrian security and military intelligence and military apparatus is extremely strong and brutal. And it's in their DNA to react violently against any protest. And so when Bashar allowed this to happen, I mean, at the end of the day, he is the president. The big difference is his father ran the country, ran the system. Bashar is the leader, but he is run by the system. And he's, in my eyes, a weak but brutal leader. But he allowed this repression, armed repression, to happen. And from the very beginning, it's so simplistic and primitive, their public diplomacy. But it turned out to be effective to a certain extent, because it turned out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. They said these were terrorists. These were not people of good intentions. These were terrorists. Well, as the civil war and the sectarian warfare deepened as a result of the violence, the devastation, indeed, the terrorists came into the country, as we know, as I mentioned in my earlier remarks. And indeed, there is a terrorism factor that the regime now claims is the cause of all of this. So, in sum, I think that in diplomacy, you have to be realistic. This regime holds on to important elements of power. It has to be dealt with in any transition. One can just not say that he's a brutal dictator and he has to go. You got to find a way to make him go. And if you're not going to take military action or very forceful action to do that, you have to find the various formulae in which he can step down. That's why I think I mentioned the prospect of elections over a period of time to prepare for them and to see if that will do the trick. But there's no question in my mind, to answer your question directly, that Syria is obviously looking at a post-Assad future.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul DeVires with the New York Divinity School.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Jajurjan. I have a question about what is the United States' interest at the table, and in particular, how high in whatever interests you think we have, how high does the protection of religious minorities rank in that collection of interests? And perhaps a subtle question is, how can we encourage our government to be putting that as a top priority?
Well, I think the most effective role the United States can play to protect the religious minorities in Syria is to really do everything possible to get the country to a point where there is a ceasefire and the killing stops, and they can proceed along the lines we've been discussing toward a political transition. That's the best thing the United States can do. In the interim, it should be doing everything in my mind in terms of humanitarian assistance and outreach to religious minorities to see how we can help. You know, it's a real tragedy. The you know, Syria was and still is, but a beautiful mosaic of confessional groups, Muslim, Christian, at one time Jewish, and many other groups, as you all know, be they Druze, Kurds, Alawites, all the various sects of Christianity. I mean, of course, you know very well, better than I do, that the Syrian Christian patriarchates represent the original church of Christianity. All the Greek Orthodox, the Melkites, the Maronites, the Armenians, the Latin Church, you just name it. They all have had a historical, and I would say, yes, a very historical presence in Syria. All of that is diminishing. That critical heritage is now under such great threat that it could alter the historic roots of Christianity in Syria and in Lebanon and in the region. That's one of the stakes that I tried to allude to, that if Syria does devolve into a massive turmoil and instability, the stakes are very high, not only for national security interests, but for these cultural and religious interests also. So the answer to your question is that the United States should really be upfront in trying to get a peaceful resolution of this. That's the best salvation for the minorities. And beyond that, to try to do everything through the humanitarian programs to help the minority communities.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sarah Cobb with George Mason University.
Yes, hello. My name is Sarah Cobb, and I'm faculty here at the School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. And I have a question about, sir, what you see to be the potential for the role of the OIC. I find it strangely absent as an interlocutor in all of this, and I would like your perspective on that. Thank you.
That's a very good question. I really don't know what the position of the OIC is, and I must admit I don't even know if they made any statements on the conflict. To your knowledge, have they?
No, sir. They're strangely silent, and I've been curious about, you know, how they would begin to cast their role and what you know, they could do as an interlocutor, but I'm...
Well, I think one of the problems is that in terms of the outside regional powers, Saudi Arabia has been supporting various elements of the opposition. They're diametrically opposed to
yeah.
Bashar al-Assad's regime, and their geopolitical calculus is that this is an extension of Iran's Shiite influence into the heart of the Arab world, and as Saudi Arabia is the custodian of the two holy places and the representative of Sunni Islam, they are involved have been involved in providing money and arms to certain elements of the opposition. Qatar has done it to other groups, the UAE. I think one of the reasons, and I'm just speculating here, that the OIC may not have come up with any common position is that within the
right.
OIC, some key Arab countries have different agendas.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Marcia Vanderberg.
Ambassador, very much. That was very enlightening for someone who looks at Asia more than the Middle East. I wonder if you might give us a sense for the Israeli brief in the discussions and what issues that might pose for the U.S. and the U.S. position. Thank you.
Well, the Israelis are carefully watching and maintaining their options. If they see something that will affect Israel's national security interests, they'll act. They've already done that in terms of targeting militarily transport of missiles to Hezbollah within Syria and into Lebanon and other directions. So the Israelis will certainly look at stemming Hezbollah's influence in Lebanon and in Syria, and they'll continue those actions. They'll be looking they're very worried about the influx of these Islamic radical groups that I mentioned, and they consider that to be a growing threat. But they don't see themselves as being a player in the formulating the future. I think they wisely realize that they cannot play, because of the Arab-Israeli conflict, because of the outstanding Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that they will not have an active role. Of course, you have the unsettled business of the Golan Heights. They do not have a peace treaty, obviously, with Syria, and they're just going to hang on to the Golan Heights as a strategic asset, especially with this turmoil in Syria. More and more Israelis will argue that how in God's name can we give up the Golan Heights when the country is devolving into such chaos? So I think it's careful watching, waiting, and reacting when they see a very defined a threat. Now, the Israelis are bolstered by the agreement that was reached, orchestrated by the U.S. and Russia on the dismantlement of the chemical and bacteriological weapons of Syria. I didn't mention that, and I should have, but that is a major achievement. I think the administration bumbled its way toward that agreement. It wasn't the most coherent policy formulation, but at the end of the day, the results were good. The Russians literally took the coals out of our fire and use their influence with the Assad's regime. And I think that if indeed the dismantlement continues along its current course, that's a huge factor that in Israel's eyes, Syria's CWBW capabilities were a major threat. And so the dismantlement of that weaponry, and Bashar al-Assad his regime made a very important calculus in doing that under pressure from the Russians. But that the Israelis see as a positive factor.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Just a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 now. Our next question comes from Robert Puckett with Indiana State University.
Which particular groups in the opposition actually prefer the collapse of any kind of centralized government in Syria?
Of any kind of what government?
Which groups, if any, in the opposition actually prefer the collapse of sovereignty of any kind in Syria, so that the state would, or what was the state, would evolve into different areas of control?
Well, I don't think, except for the Islamic radical groups, who would see an interest in the collapse of state sovereignty so that they can establish in its stead an Islamic state under Sharia law, I don't see any of the opposition groups that would be advocating the collapse of Syrian sovereignty and the nation state. none of them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Tim Rivera with the British Council.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my question. You alluded to in an answer to an earlier question to many of the religious actors and religions that have historically been present in Syria. Do you think there's a sort of a proper appreciation for the religious dynamics at work in the current conflict in Syria? And do you think sort of there's any appreciation of those dynamics in the discussions that may be going on in Geneva?
I don't know if they're specifically addressing the religious dimensions in Geneva, but that the religious factor is certainly there, because what's at stake, of course, is the integrity of the Syrian nation state. And as I mentioned, Syria has for centuries been a mosaic of various confessions, and that paradigm is replicated in Lebanon and in Iraq, for example, where you have multi-confessional societies, both within Islamic groups, Christian groups, Druze, Kurds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the religious factor is always there in the background, but I don't think it's being directly expressed. You know, it's interesting. Even when I was in Syria, as early back as 1988-91, when you spoke to Syrians, they didn't identify themselves as Muslims or Christians or Druze or Kurds or whatever. They identified themselves as Syrians. And there were intermarriages, there were families that would celebrate various religious holidays with other confessional groups. The confessional factor was not up front. It was truly a multi-confessional society. That is being destroyed by this civil war. And I hope it is not destroyed definitively, but that's why, again, it's very important that I think the best thing, in response to an earlier question, the best thing that the United States can do and the outside powers can do to preserve the role of this confessional paradigm in minorities is to get the killing stanched and to come to a political transition.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Ruppert with the Eckerd College.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, for your comments. I do have a question, given your earlier discussion on the fate of Assad. Given your comments about the brutality and effectiveness of the security forces, if there is a negotiated treaty that settles this, how do they get reintegrated into the society that remains multi-religious and multicultural?
With great difficulty. I mean, that will be. You see, I think one of the terrible syndromes of any autocratic regime like this that is so tightly knit at the top by the military and the security apparatus is that they all look at each other and go, either we got to band together or we fall together.
Right.
And I think this syndrome plays very heavily on Bashar al-Assad. He simply is not the strong leader that his father was. His father put together this structure way back in the 70s. He was very decisive, at times brutally decisive, as in Hama in 82 when he crushed the Muslim Brotherhood uprising. But the fact remains that when we in the United States at the time, we negotiated several things with Hafez al-Assad. Ending the civil war in Lebanon, Desert Storm, getting him on board the coalition. I personally negotiated with him and his interlocutor the freedom of travel of Syrian Jews. We got our U.S. hostages began to be released from Beirut that were in the hands of Hezbollah, and we used the Syrians as our channel to the Iranians. And one of the highest culminations was President Bush 41 and Secretary Baker putting together the Madrid Peace Conference, in which we got Syria and all of Israel's Arab neighbors together to talk about the framework for Arab-Israeli peace. But it was the negotiations were arduous, they were torturous, they were difficult, but the man made decisions. And when he said yes, it was yes. When he said no, it was no. I mean, it's remarkable. Yitzhak Rabin told me before I went out to Syria as ambassador, he was Minister of Defense in a meeting in Washington, a luncheon that the Secretary of Defense, Frank Carlucci, gave from him. And Frank Carlucci told Rabin, he said, well, Ed Jerej is going to be our next ambassador to Syria. And Rabin looked at me, and he made this statement that proved to be so true. After I left Syria in 3 years, he said, you know, you're going to be dealing with one of the most intelligent leaders in the Arab world. He's brutal. He's an autocrat. But when he says yes, it's yes. When he says no, it's no. You can take it to the bank. That has been our experience in Israel. Now, when I contrast that with Bashar al-Assad, you can never take his yes or no to be definitive. I've only had 3 meetings with him, but he is a case study of ambiguity. And I just don't trust his word.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from John Strimlew with the Carter Center.
Thanks very much. When I come to work at the Carter Center, some days I talk first to our transition options development folks who are thinking very creatively, as you are, Ambassador, about the political possibilities, and I think the bottle's half full. Then I talk to our young data processors who are looking at the deployment of the opposition groups and the fragmentation of those groups, and I can envision the worst case, the implosion. So let me ask you a little bit about the worst case for a moment, because while we all pray it doesn't happen, we don't have much experience in getting the international community around questions of extreme violence, which they do seem prepared to organize themselves for. The only case of the R2P, or the responsibility to protect, of course, is Libya, and we saw what happened there. They got a consensus in New York, and it broke down once NATO intervened. Can you speculate a little bit on from your Baker Center hat on what kind of a pulling back from the brink of the worst-case implosion might lead to some sort of a coordinated intervention, and where the leadership for that would come from? Is it going to be from the UN or from NATO or from where?
But when you talk about a coordinated initiative, are you talking politically, militarily, or in what way?
I'm talking about both, unfortunately, because I don't think you can do the political and military without the political. But you were positing earlier that, and I think you're right, that the implosion of Syria would be such into disadvantage of all the other leaders. We're seeing this in other parts of the world, too, by the way. It's very interesting. They can agree about containing violence in conflicts in Africa, for example, the neighbors, but then they can't. For the further on action about transition, that's when you sort of say, well, let the internal actors have a more forceful vote, a more salient role. But I'm trying to get my mind around who would put a brake on the complete implosion of Syria if the worst case, when we look at our fractionated thousands of different impulses coming from these groups that are fighting in the streets, you begin to see how far it's deteriorated, over the last 18 months, 2 years.
Well, I think in terms of U.S. policy, I think we missed the boat approximately a year and a half, 2 years ago.
I agree.
We here at the Institute, you mentioned what we're doing. We did a policy report. We've done a couple of policy reports on Syria, but the original one we did, we very actively promoted the idea to the Obama administration that the administration should start identifying and carefully vetting the Syrian opposition forces to those that we could, with some semblance of realism, begin to support both in terms of humanitarian assistance, economic assistance, and limited military assistance. We never advocated boots on the ground in Syria, and I still don't advocate that.
Yep.
Simply put, we felt that given what I mentioned about the resilience of this Syrian Baathist regime and its hermetically sealed military intelligence apparatus, that the playing field in Syria had to be leveled to a certain extent, where the regime didn't enjoy this virtual monopoly of air power, missile power, heavy mm-hmm. armor, because it would continue to have the perception that it could win. So we felt that as early as 2 years ago, as late as whatever, that the administration should really start leading an international coalition of bolstering the Syrian opposition. In order to enhance the prospects of what we've been talking about this morning and this afternoon, when negotiations start, that there'd be more of a level playing field between the opposition and the regime. I think we've lost that opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think the administration was too reluctant, too risk-averse to engage in this manner. And I can understand where President Obama is coming from, winding down, you know, having wound down the war in Iraq, and we see the devastating results there now. It's not a very pretty picture after so much blood and treasure has been lost, both of Iraqis and Americans and coalition forces. And we're debating the end game of Afghanistan, two of our major military interventions in the Middle East, which are not tidy at all, to say the least. But for, short of that type of military intervention, I think we lost the moment. And therefore, now at these discussions in Geneva, the opposition is at a disadvantageous position. It could have been in a more advantageous position to do what you're indicating, is that to stem the worst-case scenario. So that's history. What we can do now is support what's going on, but I still think we should be stepping up to the plate to bolster the opposition more strongly, because after all, if you look at it objectively, Syria is getting support by Russia, military, economic, political. Syria is getting political support even from China. But more importantly, Iran is supporting the Syrian regime both militarily, financially, politically, Hezbollah. I mean, the playing field is very uneven. And that's one aspect of American foreign policy that I think has been deficient.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Zahar Salu with the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago.
Thank you, Ambassador. Actually, I'm also with the Syrian American Medical Society, which is a medical relief organization. I went to Syria in several medical missions. And what is really stark is the absence of the UN agencies and humanitarian international agencies in northern and eastern Syria. So in spite of the effort of SAMS, my organization, and other NGOs, but there's complete absence of the UN in an area that serves about 10 million people. And we've been advocating for UNSC mandate for cross-border humanitarian assistance from Turkey and probably from Jordan to the south. Why is it that we're not able to convince the Russian to go with us with this humanitarian resolution adopted by the UNSC? And my second question is about if Bashar al-Assad accepted that he will not run for election, which I doubt, this year, who would be the main candidates for such election?
Well, first, in response to your second question, I don't know who the main candidate would be because of the total political monopoly of power of this regime for over 40 years. It's very difficult to determine. But believe me, when you have an election process started, people come to the fore. Sometimes it's a surprise to everybody, but the Syrians are very intelligent. I don't have to tell you this, but it's a very intelligent society with a long cultural history and a highly educated society. So there are people that would come to the fore at any elections. They're just, it's just unknown at this point. And there'll probably be compromise candidates in the very beginning. But if the political process, participation process starts in Syria, then I think a new generation of leaders will emerge in Syria. So I'm not pessimistic about that. In terms of your first question, and I respect the work that you're doing in northern and eastern Syria, I think you have a very good idea there. I think the United Nations Security Council should focus on this initiative you mentioned. I attach some importance to magnifying the U.S.-Russian agreement on chemical weapons and bacteriological weapons to what we're seeing in Geneva II in terms of U.S.-Russian cooperation. It seems that Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov have a good relationship. That's good. And to magnify that, not only in the political discussions going on in Geneva, but to magnify it along the lines you mentioned in terms of humanitarian assistance, I think it would be a great idea to have a United Nations Security Council mandate that with the Russians and the Chinese, the PERM reps, of course, obviously all on board, that could have an impact on opening the corridors. But again, you see, if they do make progress on these aid corridors, that could be brought to the UN and magnified into a much more serious humanitarian effort. So I think that's something that should be promoted.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Aso Tavidian with the Tavidian Foundation.
Hi, Ed. This is Aso Tavidian.
How are you?
Good. Could you comment, an excellent presentation, thank you very much. Could you comment on the effects of the turmoil in Syria on Turkey?
Yes, well, first there was a, you've got to understand that you're going back, Prime Minister Erdogan and President Gül of Turkey really made an effort to advise and counsel Bashar al-Assad. And they thought that they had a special relationship, that they could influence him. They were highly deceived when Bashar al-Assad took the decisions that he did and really initiated this violent repression of the protests and the demonstrations in Syria and the subsequent bloodbath. And they felt that he had deceived them in whatever talks they had. By the way, this is also true of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who also tried to mentor Bashar al-Assad and was deceived. And it gets back to my biographical portrait of this young man, is that he's ambivalent, to say the least. He's still the leader. He makes decisions, but he's much more the captive of the inner clique, and I don't think he's a totally decision maker as his father was. So the Turks cut off their relationship with Syria. They have some very strong national security interests in Syria. It's not only the refugee influx into Turkey, which the Turks have given, you know, established refugee camps and opened their doors to Syrian refugees, but for the Turks, their highest national security interest on the border with Syria is the Kurds. Are the Kurds, and as you know, the Kurdish problem for Turkey is an existential one in terms of Turkey's territorial integrity. Southeastern Turkey is highly populated by Kurds. You know, they've had problems with the PKK in the past and even up to the present, and calls for Kurdish independence and autonomy. And Syria's northern provinces, northeast, has a large Kurdish population. If Syria falls asunder and the various ethnic groups go their way, this will have a very serious impact on Turkey's national security interests. What will the Kurds do? Will they ally themselves with the Iraqi Kurds? Will they ally themselves with the Kurds inside Turkey? Will there be a movement toward irredentism? So these are very serious issues that the Turkish government has to face. That's why I think there will be strong proponents of a successful Geneva process. And I think they have to be key elements in any solution.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Matthew Welch with the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Hello. And actually, this is a question of Ambassador Young, who unfortunately had to leave early. But it's a follow-up question to the previous one, which the question is, about sharing the burden on refugees. And the region, as you pointed out, Ambassador, includes two over 2 million refugees in neighboring countries, and yet so far the United States on an annual basis has just been resettling a handful. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that and how we might share more of that refugee burden.
You mean resettling Syrian refugees in the United States?
Yes.
Yeah, that's always a political it's a problem with political connotations, because I think the first impulse is that political refugees be or refugees be resettled in the region in the first instance, and then there are so many, as you can well imagine, national security interests involved in vetting refugee populations and who you bring into the country. Remember, we've been very marked by 9/11, and when you look at the turmoil inside of Syria now and you realize that there are terrorist groups in there, or Islamic radical groups and other elements, I think there'll be the what I'm saying basically is that the United States intelligence agencies, security agencies, the CIA, the FBI, will have the Homeland Security will have a very heavy voice in whatever decisions are made on that. Unfortunately, in terms of the humanitarian crisis, it doesn't help in terms of the United States opening its doors to Syrian refugees. But I think on a case-by-case basis, that's the best one could hope for at this point.
Well, I think we are at the end of our hour. Ambassador Jurijian, thank you very much for your analysis and insights. I think we will all agree that this is a terrific way to spend this time, and we always love hearing from you.
Okay, my pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you all for being with us, and we will send the announcement of the next call under separate cover. So thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.